Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. And if you hear that in the background, her name is Brosi. And I'm with Aramar Tefio. This is Get Around. And we're going to start right off with Tea Talk with Monique Johnson.
Well, hello, hello, everyone. It's so nice to be here today. This is Monique Johnson with HealthyMovementsInternational.com. And our Tea Talk today, first, just a little background. We have been talking a little bit about the energy centers and balancing them by way of the heart. And the energy centers, which are also called the chakras, C-H-A-K-R-A, and we start to, it becomes very helpful to inquire of our energy centers and how clear they are or how blocked they are to make us, to help us to be better creators of what we would like to experience. Also, to help us to understand when there are shadows that are driving our lives or driving our decision-making process, we can see those shadows clearly and kind of clear them so that the way that we are living life is a very mindful one. It's a very it's not reactive but active. And that is, many have found that to be the more healthy way of living life, and that there doesn't become a time where it's like we're creating things in our life and it's like, I don't know why I'm creating that. I don't want to experience it. And so by working through the chakras and understanding our energy centers, we can begin to remedy some of those experiences. So the heart is the fulcrum. There are three energy centers below it and three above it. We've been balancing. Speaking of balancing, the two energy centers that are nearest the heart, which below would be the third one, which is our solar plexus, deals with our empowerment or giving our power away. The one above it is the throat chakra, which deals with living your own personal truth and speaking it freely, being able to choose to be in any kind of situation that you decide to, but doing it with consciousness, with openness. And so then we move up one and down one. So that the heart is the fourth, which is the center. Then we just talked about the third and the fifth. Now we're going to move up one from the fifth to the sixth. So from the throat chakra up to the third eye chakra. So the third eye is also its own energy center, and it's kind of located right in your third eye, or kind of the center of the forehead between the eyebrows. And it deals with your connectedness and your ability to interact in your life and use intuition and the things, the synchronicities of life and the messages that you get from your healthy being or from your life on how to direct your steps. Now, its sister chakra would be the second chakra, which deals with your sacral and deals with your sensual and sexual self. So, but what we're going to focus on now is the upper chakra, which is the third eye. Now, remember, the three above deals with our energy connection to that which is greater than self. It deals with our higher self. It deals with more of our energetic self. And the lower chakras, the first through three, one through three, deal with our earth self, our dense self, our physical self, more so our ego self, the stuff that is really connected to the existence of here on earth. So as we balance those, then, of course, our intention would be, if we are intending to balance, is to hold consciousness, expanded awareness. Remember, consciousness is just your awareness with your intelligence married together. So we are holding consciousness in both chakras at the same time, and that helps us to find our balance. And remember, balance looks different for different people. It is, balance is not something, as I speak of it, it's not something we would look on the outside and tell another person you are not balanced. Nor is it, so it's not a way of, we're not going through this to judge others. We are the intention of going through this information is to, one, always stay in a place of self-love and compassion, and then to be able to clearly look at the mirror in life and the mirrors of life to self-assess. And then as we self-assess, then we begin to make different inquiries or experiences or changes so that we can find that balance. So that's why we're doing it. It's not about judging another being and their balance. So when we are in the third eye, then we are able to embrace our own truth about life. Because the energy of the chakra of the throat, that energy moves up into the third eye. And so it brings its own energy with it. And as it moves from the throat place, which is really kind of speaking the awareness and stuff, and going up into the third eye, we're moving into the more emotional thought process. And then, of course, after that, it moves up into pure consciousness, which is our seventh chakra. So in this chakra, we do deal with a lot our thought process. What is our emotional belief system? What is our conditioned mental thinking? It really starts to help us to look at the rights and wrongs in our own thought patterns, because there is an existence beyond the polar opposites. There's an existence beyond right, wrong, good, bad, should, shouldn't. But in this chakra, when the energy really starts working in this chakra, then we are encouraged to even look at the conditionings and start to allow them to fall away. Because with the intention chakra fully active and working in a proper way for our life, then we really don't need the checklists anymore. The checklists of if I do that, I'm good. If I do that, I'm good. You know, right, wrong, good, bad, should, shouldn't. All of these checklists that we have, this chakra center will start to help us to really identify what checklist we're living by and it have the intuition to know if we even need those anymore, those conditionings. So we start to learn and live through experiencing instead of through the mental right, wrong, good, bad ways of living life, which is governed by external constraints. Because if we think about it now, each energy center, it has a emotion that's connected to it that helps it run fully and free. And then there's the opposite, the flip side of that emotion will also start to block the chakras. So when we are looking at this chakra, we are trying to at least start to find out for ourselves the illusions of separation. When we really start to have the intuition open, then we start to intuit that we are all connected and that there's a thread that runs through all of us, and that thread can be called anything. Some people call it God. Some people call it universe. In this moment, I'd like to call it life. That the thread of life, the vibration of life runs through all of us. And so when we get very intuitive and that energy center starts to open up and be active, we automatically embody the very essence that separation is an illusion. And that through that illusion, we can choose to play that game of the illusion or not to. It's not about right, wrong, good, bad, should play it, should not play it. We step out of the game of the illusion, whether it exists or doesn't exist, and we just move from the place of intuition. And then if we're in a situation that somehow we need to embrace the illusion of separation, let's say we're going into the bank and we need to deposit money in our bank account, well, we do want to play the game of separation in that moment because we're not trying to lay our money on the counter and they just put it and give it to everybody. We really want to direct it to a certain place. so in that moment, for something that simple or whatever, the game of illusion works. So as a conscious being, as a person who their upper chakras are starting to be active, you are able to, we are able to discern when the game or when the hat of illusion is in place, when to keep that hat on and when to take it off. So when it comes to like showing compassion and love and acceptance, then we take off the illusion of separation and we know we're all a part of life. So we have the ability and exercise the capacity to spread that love to all people and not be so, oh, well, you know, I tolerate what you, how you live your life and, you know, so all that stuff just kind of floats away. So this is a very helpful chakra to be aware of and to start to awaken the awareness of this one. Then the things you will start to think about as you're going in your life, the exercises you'll start to kind of be more aware of is when do you act as if you don't know that we are all connected.
Wow.
So when in your life, from day to day, in your thought pattern, because maybe it doesn't show up in your life a lot. Maybe you're a good, proper citizen and you know how to hide it. But, you know, be honest with the person in the mirror. That's the whole point of this. And so, you know, start to be aware as you walk around in your life is when do you act as if the person you're talking to, the person you're connected to, that y'all are different, that there's a hierarchy there. And one way, a good way, when I started to kind of delve into this, one way I always knew that I was conscious and aware is when I went through a drive-through or when I checked out at the grocery store or when I came into contact with someone who was giving me a menial service, a service that, you know, you get all the time. If I was so much into the separation and into the mine, M-I-N-E, of it all, then I would not lift my eyes to look that person in the eye, to, if nothing else, to acknowledge their existence and to show them a kindness for the service that they gave me. I would be more in the mindset of, well, they're supposed to give me that service. They make $7, $8 an hour. So as we expand in this area, we're able to have, we, a lot of times you will start to experience a greater capacity to have love and compassion for just the everyday person. And when that is active, when you're able to do that, then you know that separation, that illusion of separation is not your driving force on your day-to-day. You're able to give out compassion to the person working behind the Starbucks counter, to the person who's checking you out who may be in a bad mood, but you're able to see there's no separation there and you've been in a bad mood and done your work before, so you still have compassion for that person. So that is the introduction to the sixth chakra, the third eye. We'll go a little bit deeper into this because as we these upper chakras have many ways of experiencing them to expand them. So we'll go a little bit more into that next time. But thank you so much,
well,
Ms. Rosanne.
I do have a question, if that's okay.
Yes, please, yes.
Before you come back next Wednesday, we will have observed Maybon, which is the equinox, the autumnal equinox.
Yes.
And is there any special balancing routine or something that you would suggest for this?
I can give a couple of balls I'll throw up for people.
Okay.
I mean, like, my advice is worth about 2 cents, and 2 cents don't buy you bubblegum no more.
No.
Yes, no, I hear you. So what I would say is, Anytime there's a celestial change, anytime there is a seasonal change, because if we are looking at ourselves as elements of this physical being, is an element of this earth, is an element of this, our celestial being in our universe. So any time that there's a change there, more than likely, if you're a very awake person and you're connected to that part of you, then you will feel a change. The mm-hmm. best thing that I can give as an option is, one, to always be okay with changes, variations. And then secondly, I would say, remain grounded, do things that keep you grounded, and that will help you through the process of any change. And I hear music playing. Are you there, Ruthann? Well, I guess this will be Monique signing off. I hope y'all got that for some of the techniques to help you to stay connected during the equinox. Have a beautiful day. This has been Monique Johnson, HealthyMovementsInternational.com. Bye-bye.
Apologies to everybody, to Monique Johnson, for cutting her short. I was having a little bit of an issue here with Skype and BTR, but evidently things are settled. So we have with us Tariq Jerobirkin. Now, did I pronounce your name right, Tariq?
Yes. My name is Tariq Jerobirkin, and I've lived in Montreal pretty much my whole life, and got some very interesting stuff coming up in terms of Canadian election politics. I don't know if that's such a big deal with your listeners or not.
Well, we have listeners from around the world, and a lot of people in other countries are very much more sophisticated as far as political things go than a lot of the people in the U.S. And I'm not saying, I mean, there's a lot of people in other countries, of course, that aren't either. But I've been very pleasantly surprised by people around the world who know so much about what's going on in this hemisphere. And so I think that people are interested in Canada. And, you know, every time somebody mentions the Harper government, I see all these rantings all over the internet. And so I think that it's not the most popular government, sort of like the one in the U.S.
I would think so.
I'd like to first, how you got interested in politics.
Well, I guess you could say that I sort of got forced into it because sort of what you learn in school growing up in Canada is that being active, vocal, that sort of thing in Canadian politics is sort of your civil duty. I don't know if that is the same feeling that applies in the United States so much as in the United States, I think, feeling of patriotic and serving your country is your duty, whereas in Canada, it's more of playing an active role in participating in your democracy, maybe taking a stand on a specific issue, passing out leaflets or putting together a flyer or something like that.
That's different. Yeah, that is different. Because here, they would just as soon, you know, you have to pass the Constitution test or something, but that's about it. They don't really want you to get involved.
That seems to be the problem, and I've talked about this in some of my writing. I don't think it's specific to just Canada or just the United States. If you look across the Commonwealth countries like England, Canada, recently Australia, all of those governments have had the same pattern, which is you have a conservative government that has taken power, although you have the predominant voting majority of those countries who seem to have more open leftward leaning views themselves. I don't know if the similar pattern indicates maybe a larger maybe pattern is at work, but in Canada what we're trying to do is be the first country which recognizes what's going on here, and hopefully we could be the first country that shows the other countries how to break out of this paradigm, perhaps. Is that being a bit too optimistic?
No, I'm an optimist at heart, so I'm all for it. Please, be the first country to show people how to break out.
Okay, I sent you some poll numbers today.
Mm-hmm.
The latest poll results in Canada, and Canada's political situation is very topsy-turvy. We have three parties. Right now we have the Liberals, the Conservatives, and the NDP. And historically, the Liberals have represented the middle class.
We should say that the NDP is the New Democratic Party.
Absolutely. The Liberals have represented the middle class. The New Democratic Party, the NDP, represents the working class, and the Conservatives represent the business class. That has historically been the division of and who represents who in Canadian politics. Now, we had a Liberal government in Canada for the longest time representing the middle class, and they were in power for so long that one could say that they grew a little bit comfortable in their position. And with comfort in power, those two sort of often lead hand in hand and lead down the primrose path to corruption, which is what resulted in the Canadian voters kicking the Liberals out of power in 2006. Now, it would have been the preference of many, many Canadians at that point in time to replace the Liberals with the New Democratic Party, who were the historic representatives of the working class. Problem was, though, in Canada, the Canadian establishment, the Canadian corporations, the Canadian businesses, the Canadian sponsors, they weren't ready to have a government that was an actual, true, honest representative of the working class. So what we got was the Conservative Party instead. Not because they were the best Canada could do, but because they may have been the best available option at the time. Now, what's happened over the last 10 years in Quebec specifically is that the corruption that people had identified with the Liberal Party have slowly but surely transferred themselves into the New Democratic Party, the Working Class Party. And that sort of, once again, leaves us in the lurch in terms of, as Canadian citizens, who are we supposed to vote for to represent us? Because we clearly know who represents the business class and the corporations, but who represents the working people? We can still think that the Liberals represent the middle class, but do the working people still have a party in Canada? And that's what we're trying to find out here in Canada. And if we can see that the New Democratic Party actually still prioritizes representing the working people of Canada and is not going to sell out to corporate interests in order to acquire power, then the NDP might have our support in the next election. They definitely had our support in the previous election when, for the first time, they were actually voted into opposition status, as opposed to being third party, always in the corner of the house, the third man in sort.
So opposition is a better place to be than third party?
Well, you've got your government, then you've got your opposition, and then you've got your third party. Now, when it's a majority government, opposition is usually the better place to be. That means that even if all the opposition members in Parliament, including the third party, pool all their votes, they still won't be able to outvote what the government wants to get across the floor of the House of Parliament. So when there's a majority government, when the government can basically do anything it wants, that's the way parliamentary democracy works when the government has a majority, then opposition is the best place to be. However, when the government has a minority, when there is a possibility that opposition parties, by working together, would be able to upset and question the confidence of the government in house, therefore bringing down the government, sometimes third party is the best place to be because you actually hold the deciding vote in your hand, whether or not the government will stay or whether or not the government can go. And that has been the specialty of the New Democratic Party in Canada over the last 50 years when we've had minority governments. What Canadians were interested in seeing, what their working class base of support was interested in seeing over the last maybe 5 or 10 years that they've stepped up and replaced the Liberals as number two in the polls, is that the NDP, the New Democratic Party, could actually be leaders themselves, could actually make the decisions and take the lead instead of simply protecting the interests of the people while others above us supposedly took the lead themselves.
Okay. Well, so then now, when you say that we may support the NDP, if they prove that, you know, they're going to do what you want. But who is we?
I think we is the working classes. We is the people of Canada. That's a general description of we. I'll give you a much more specific definition of we. Lots of the New Democratic Party's seats in the House of Parliament came directly from Quebec. Because all the supporters of the Liberal Party in Quebec that had voted Red Liberal over the last two decades, once they recognized the Red Liberals were corrupt, they were the ones who switched their vote from Red Liberal to Orange New Democratic Party. Now, we switched our votes so that the change of corruption and ending this dependence on corruption that the political parties in Quebec that we elect to represent us seem to have ends. But if the NDP is just going to provide the same corruption as the Liberals before them, then we're going to have to try to find another representative. And at this point, there aren't too many others. So we might either have to settle for the NDP again. We might either have to go back to the Liberals.
Well, what do you say to overthrowing the system and doing something totally different?
That's what we've all been waiting for. It's not so much that the system itself is broken. It's more that the system itself has been so perfected by the corporate powers that use the system.
Well, because it's
a
capitalist system.
Exactly.
We know
that
capitalism doesn't work, So as far as trying to, you know, mend something that doesn't work, in my opinion, it's better to get rid of it and try something different.
Absolutely. The purpose of capitalism is to separate the resources from the rich from the poor and to keep the resources for the rich. Yeah. Now, as the poor, if you want to use that black and white comparison.
A lot of people are falling into that who 10 years ago didn't. But it,
yeah.
You know, yeah, use the word poor because that's what it is.
Okay, so as the poor, then if we want a party to represent us and our interests against the rich who are controlling the system, then basically we have to make sure that that party remains absolutely honest, absolutely integral, absolutely credible, and absolutely free from even the possibility of selling out to corporate sponsors and stuff. And
well,
what this system has been perfected to do,
you're going
go ahead.
To have that. As long as there's corporations, there will be corruption.
This exactly.
It's just a fact of life.
And so what we have to do is we have to sort of take the political democracy we have and try to get it back into the hands of the people rather than the corporations. And I know that's an old talking point, but the only way I think you can do that is to have political parties who represent the people that are not going to sell out for corporate support. So if we continue to follow a system that is based on acquiring corporate support to get votes, to get your financial budgets to run your campaigns, then by all means, you've said it yourself, Ruthann, we aren't going to be able to affect change. We might just have to change the system.
I think the system definitely needs to change. But what you're talking about is actually just working people need to
have a representative.
Well, working people need to start doing some ground-level actions. And you know, I mean, whatever, I don't know how it is in Canada, but here, you know, we urge people to run for the school board. Do whatever in your local community, you know, build from the ground up because change isn't going to come from the top down. Any change that comes from the top down is bad for us who are not at the top. And so we've got to build it from the ground.
Absolutely.
So, sure. You know, but if you're not going to get representatives if you don't really have people working on the ground, in my opinion.
Exactly. And I'll tell you, one of the scarier things of the paradigm and the system as it works and as it is applied today is that not only does the corporate structure look to sort of prevent any alternative viewpoints from getting across by withholding funding, but there are actually entities which work to physically deter and physically prevent, those types of grassroots movements that you were referring to from actually taking place. And this is going on in Canada. And it might be going on slightly under the surface, not in plain view to anybody who wasn't looking for it. But if this is going on in Canada and in Canada's electoral ridings in 2013, imagine how easy it would be for the same corporate sources to do the same sort of thing in a Latin American country and control their elections the same way.
Yeah. Because, well, and I don't know about Canada, but, you know, the United States has done a lot to try to screw up Latin America. I mean, they have installed horrible people as dictators and, you know, ran out by killing people who were legally elected. Right now I'm talking with Tariq, let me say this, Gerald Birkin.
Yes.
You can find him at www.geraldburkin. This is JeroBurkhan. WordPress.com. And before we get into some of the things that you've been writing, tell me about the First Nations. You know, we've heard quite a bit, well, some of us, about movements that they've been starting and continuing in Canada. What's the scope on that? What do you think?
Well, there is a lot of baggage that Canada goes through itself, and there's a lot of compensation that Canada owes to its First Nations people.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the ongoing battle between the Canadian establishment to control the lives and destinies of the First Nations members versus the First Nation members themselves, who just want to have an autonomous place to live and to prosper on their own. That battle has been going on, you could jokingly say since 1492, but it's been going on since 1867 in Canada, and it never stops from the fight by First Nations to get oral treaties recognized by government entities, who more often than not will simply overlook or disregard historic agreements between government and First Nations based on the fact that, well, there was no proper documentation, and this sort of thing. And slowly but surely, bit by bit, piece of red tape by piece of red tape, the government slowly push the First Nations out of the framework, exactly like you said earlier about how the government and are now starting to push the poor people out of the framework of decision making for entire societies of which they are a part. The latest issue here. The government of Canada, the Conservative government of Canada, has proposed Bill C-45, and there are lots of reasons for complaint for this bill. There are a few good things in it, but there are a lot of reasons for complaint, and one of the biggest issues that the First Nations have with it is that the bill would allow for the government to lease First Nations land without having to first get consent of all the members of the First Nations who that land originally belongs to.
Sure.
And this was just another step too far for a lot of the Aboriginal groups. There was a new protest group. I really should know a little bit more about the origins. I believe that they were started from four women working together. The name of the group is Idle No More,
right.
And it is a movement based on sustainability of a just society and sustainability of a living environment. So you might have a piece of legislation that's great, but if it's not sustainable, if it's not going to create or enforce a just society, make a society more just, or if it's not good for the environment, or if it's not sustainable for the environment, then it's basically not good for the First Nations ideals and perspectives that this group, Idle No More, is representing. And they had a really amazing stand on Parliament Hill in Ottawa. That they would not only once or twice, but I believe it was over several weeks, there were weekly vigils and lengthy stand-ins. And just like all other sort of protests with this government, it's just stonewalled. It's just ignored because, as we mentioned earlier in the program, the current government in Canada is a majority government, which means that no matter what they do, they cannot be brought down on a single bill or a single issue. They can only be brought down by a federal election or a scandal. So once again, a majority government sort of takes the high road or go hides behind its numerical majority. But
you've talked to a couple different representatives on the radio shows.
Okay.
So
yes.
Do you have some hope?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, okay.
Absolutely. Well, 100% there's hope here. The hope couldn't have been made more clear, and I know I'm going back in time, but the hope couldn't have been made more clear in 2006 when Canadians, especially Quebecers, recognized that the government at that time was corrupt, and they voted them out of office. And the sign that gave us all hope was that, hey, you know what? We actually have a Quebec population. We actually have a people. We actually have a Canadian population who are willing to do something when there is a corrupt government in place, simply more than look to see who can get the more of the fallout from the trough for themselves,
yes.
Which had previous to that been sort of the Canadian reaction to corruption or the Quebec reaction to corruption. But since 2006, we saw that Quebecers want different. Unfortunately, the first purveyors of change that Quebecers selected to represent them in that change from corruption may or may not have been the appropriate representatives. That will remain to be seen over the next couple of months, especially because we're going to have an election in Canada within the next 15 months, which means that it will be announced within the next 6 months, which means that we'll have about a good 6 months of campaign. And that is when things are going to really get hot and heavy. And my inside information says there may be an announcement as to when the election date will be as early as October 25th of this year.
Oh, so you don't, in Canada, you don't have the election date set way ahead?
Absolutely not.
Oh.
Which
Who
gives...
Who that, then?
That's what gives even more power. That's what gives even more control to the governing conglomerate, if you will, that controls Canadian politics, which is, I mean, and it's the same thing in the United States, too. Think of someone like Bush or think of someone like Obama. The Republicans and the Democrats and the political representatives of every Senate seat and whatnot, they come and go with the elections.
Right.
But
right.
It's the corporations. It's the corporate sponsors.
Well, they remain.
They have no mandate. They don't have 4 years and up. They're the ones who basically decide who is going to be their mouthpiece for the next session, then for the next session, depending on who they decide to sponsor.
Right.
And that seems to be how it works in Canada, too. And as you totally perfectly pointed out, you know, because Canada has no set election dates, the power that the corporations and the corporate entities in Canada have to control the political conglomerates, it's beyond belief. It seems to be that it seems to me that it's been the people in the back rooms and the sky lounges of the corporate establishment who've been controlling Canadian politics for the last 20 years, simply choosing who gets to form government by rewarding those who agree to push their agendas with their sponsorship. And that seems to be the way it has worked, basically, in this country for as long as I've been paying attention to politics, which is why we get into some really, really shady territory when we talk about a working class representing party breaking into that conglomerate.
We don't have the money. And not that we would want to be that immoral anyway, but even if we wanted to, we don't have the money backing us. And because working people are working people, you know, they haven't gotten a bunch of money on the sweat of other people's work. And so they don't have it to go around bribing, lobbying, whatever you want to call it, paying off the politicians. So that's why it seems like the system has to go.
So what could we do then? I mean, let me just ask you this, like, personally, all politics aside, instead of working to break down their system, could we simply work to create an alternative system for ourselves, and then it would be their choice whether or not they want to still have us part of their entity?
That would be lovely if we could just put them on an island somewhere, which is what some people suggest. you know, sending our people from D.C. and putting them all someplace and letting us do things. I think that would be very hard, what you're saying. I mean, I personally, I do see revolution, and I see revolution coming in the streets. And I think it's not going to be like some people think. I think it's going to be them against us.
Them
being the government, the military, they're going to make the first move.
Okay. I totally think they've already made the first move. I think they've already made the first move by hijacking our democracy and then using our tax dollars to basically pay for our own sort of censorship.
Yeah.
You know, they use our tax dollars for the security that they use to censor us
to
with.
Take our rights from us. And instead of working on the, now I don't know about Canada, in the United States, one out of every four children is going to bed hungry. And instead of, you know, doing anything about that, they've cut different programs because they don't have enough money. But yet they have enough money to go kill people in other countries all the time.
That's what's absolutely mind-boggling in terms of the priorities of the corporate establishment vis-a-vis the priorities of the people whose tax dollars that they're actually responsible for spending.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to just address that point you made about sending them all to an island. The problem is, you know why they'll never go to an island? Because they still have access to our tax dollars here.
Yeah.
I think that
cut off, you know. Totally.
Do you think that this is possible? That in order to create our own system, we simply stop paying into theirs?
Sure, it is, and it's been proven time and time again that, like the income tax in the United States, it's not legal. It's, I mean, it's not hard to find that, but yet people, and I don't blame people, they're afraid not to pay it because nobody wants to go to jail. I mean, lose their job, lose their family, or see their family having to move from their house while, you know, one of the parents or somebody's in jail because they've got it so like over a
individualized.
Pardon?
I would say they've got us so thinking that we're all on our own.
Yes.
And they've got us over the barrel thinking that each one of us is simply on our own, and that if we make the decision to do something, that the weight of the world will come down on our shoulders. If we do it one by one, yes, that is what's going to happen. But if we all do it together.
Well, that's it. But if, when it comes down to getting everybody to do it together, good luck. They say that when you reach a 10% pretty much a consensus or something in some of these matters, you've got it made. If you've got 10% of the people who are active and gung-ho, you will, by having them do what they do best, you will get a lot more people on their side. So we're going for the 10%.
Okay, that's a start. That's a start, because that means that at the very least we would be having more than 1% of the population having a say in where our country's going, which is sort of what we've got on right now.
I have now. Yeah. That's, I did want to mention a couple things that talk about in one of your blogs. You wrote about the family, you know, like the government, quote unquote, family. So who's excluded, who's excluded? Is it only the 1% that's included in this family? I mean, now the government people are not in the 1%, but are they? They're part of the family, right?
There are lots more Canadians who consider themselves to be part of the family than actually are part of the family.
Okay, like middle class, maybe higher middle class. A lot of people don't like to just say, I'm poor, I'm working class. So they keep saying, well, you know, I'm middle class, I'm upper middle class, even though it doesn't mean what it used to. So they would consider themselves part of the family, maybe?
Well, I think they would. Mm-hmm. I think they would, but what it boils down to is how hard do you have to struggle in life? The reason why the 1% has its paws into the resources of the 99% is so that they don't have to struggle for anything. they basically let the 99% struggle amongst themselves, and the 1% uses the profit margin for their own sort of party, I guess you can call it. And it sort of comes down to the same thing for the family. This is my personal thesis. My personal thesis is that the decisions of what laws and legislations get passed in Canada are decided years in advance by the corporate structure, which basically decides which party is going to be in power at which given point. Sometimes there can be surprises caused by the people when they stand up and vote for a party that they know is not one of the corporate representatives. But basically the way I see it is that the legislation is going to be passed anyway. The laws are going to be passed anyway. They are planned out years in advance. When a party is elected to be government, their job is simply to promote the laws and legislations that were going to be passed anyway. And when a party is voted into opposition, their job is simply to oppose. And in the big scheme of things, my thesis is that all the parties are working together because they're all trying to curry favor from the same corporate sponsors that come from the Canadian establishment.
Okay, well, you're saying the same thing I say here about the Republicans and Democrats, then, that it's a uniparty.
Exactly.
So
that's the family. Exactly.
Yeah.
And
oh, that's depressing. Tariq, that's just plain depressing, isn't it?
Yeah.
The people, they have the power to elect, when really these people and parties are selected, not elected, but they're selected.
Exactly, except that selection is now coming at the expense of the people. You referred to that upper middle class, and where do you think that they would fit in? Do you think they would fit in among the deciders? And it seems to me that upper middle class basically are simply what are referred to as the actors, the mouthpieces.
They will say and believe what they're told to.
Exactly, and the ones with the most credibility will get the responsibility of voicing the corporate agenda to the people.
Uh-huh, okay, yeah.
And that based on their credibility is why they are selected for representing the people, but not based on their credibility with the people, but based on their credibility and the loyalty that they've shown, and their maybe malleability that they've shown, their ability to be manipulated by the corporate entities which use these people in the political rotation as their mouthpieces.
Yeah, well, and we see that here sometimes with movie stars, some Hollywood names, some sports figures.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, it's like all of a sudden, you know, somebody who comes out of whatever, who doesn't seem to have two pieces of brain to rub together, that's, I'm putting a lot of whatever, but I mean, they don't seem like they have, you know, and all of a sudden they're spouting this wonderful rhetoric. And it's like, okay, who wrote this for you? And what did they pay you?
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes though, and I think that's the stage that we're at now in Canada, and I think that it's the stage that the United States was actually at in 2008 or 2004, no, 2008, when Obama first came in. I think the United States was at this stage in 2008 after Bush, and Canada is at that stage, at this stage now. It is the stage where the corporate profit margins, which have been driven and have increased because they have lowered the standard with which they've treated the people. Mm-hmm. And they've raised their profit margins by lowering what they give back to the people. We're at the point where they simply cannot squeeze any more blood from a stone. We've given all we have to give. We have nothing left to give. They can't take away anything else from us to increase their profit margins. the only way they can increase the corporate structures can increase their profit margins through us going forward is by working together with us. They can't take anything else away from us. There's nothing left to take. They've squeezed everything they can. And I think the U.S. taxpayer was at this point in 2008. And the Canadian taxpayer is at that point now.
Mm-hmm.
I just hope that when we get our version of Obama or whatever it will be that will replace the Stephen Harper conservatives, we'll be a little bit more happy with him. I sure hope
that whoever is selected at that point is nothing like Obama. I'm one of those people who knew he was a liar from the get-go. I'm in Illinois.
Okay, that's good to know.
So I knew, and people were just, he's going to save us. And I remember after the election, the next morning, I was talking to a friend who was a very adamant Obama supporter, and I said, I just hope that this is going to work. She, it'll be wonderful, and look at it. She is still an Obama apologist, though. She's one of those people.
It's sometimes more that they don't want to admit that they themselves were wrong for believing in the first place, rather than the fact that they still believe in the man or his policies.
Yep, I've noticed that some people it's very hard to say, man, I was so wrong, I was so taken in. So they just go on trying to find something. Well, he has a pretty smile. I mean, give me a break. I mean, what else, can you give me something besides a smile?
Well, I'll just say this. What you saw in Obama before he took power, that what you expected, that he was just going to be a right-wing puppet, is what a lot of Quebecers who supported Thomas Mulcair, who's the leader of the New Democratic Party in the last election, it's exactly the same experience that they've gone through with the man who they voted to bring change to the corruption in Quebec.
And that's such a I know people just have to see. I don't feel betrayed because I never believed him.
good way of putting it.
Well, sure, he betrayed the country. He's betrayed everybody, but I don't take it personally because I didn't believe him. So he hasn't surprised me. But people who really did, they take it as a personal betrayal, and that's very hard to stomach. I know that.
Yeah, especially when they take it out on those around them instead of aiming up, because up prospers when those of us who they all contain and control take out our frustrations against ourselves rather than pooling our forces. and I know that there is a lot of cynicism against us ever being able to work together from the base of the people to ever overcome the financial stranglehold that UP has. But I gotta hope that there's still hope out there, at least.
Yeah. I am optimistic. I think somehow what we're all doing, and I think it's going to make a difference because, people will tell us, wow, okay, now I get it kind of thing. And we're not doing it to hear that, but it's nice to hear it. But I think that people are waking up and they're really tired. And if Occupy did nothing else, and, people have different views on Occupy. I think it was wonderful myself. But what it did was start to empower people and show people that they can do something, and other people are feeling what they're feeling. So
I think the biggest benefit of the Occupy movement is that, okay, you used the word it empowered people. I think the biggest benefit of the Occupy movement was that it made people realize that they should not be afraid to use the technology that in some cases they've been harnessed with for their own advantage.
Yes.
And not simply allow themselves to be used by UP for the advantage of UP, because UP has us intimidated into thinking that this technology is only for their use and that we're criminals if we use it ourselves.
Exactly. Well put.
I think that is the power of the Occupy movement, and I think that it will not only spur a lot of confidence in people moving forward, but I think that that movement hopefully will trigger something bigger, something more inclusive, something... We're always waiting for something more. We're always waiting for something more. Maybe that's part of our corporate indoctrination process too.
That might be. Or I don't want to do anything until. And it's like back to, well, if not now, when? Just the time. You also mentioned butterfly effect. We've only got a couple minutes. Do you want to tell us about the butterfly effect?
Basically, I think it's pretty clear how, since we are living in an interconnected world with networks that have one entity affecting another entity, even though one entity might not even know the other exists, basically when we're living in an interconnected world, everything you do has a reaction caused somewhere. Everything you do has an effect on something somewhere. Mm-hmm. And when you are in the position of the 1%, you are in a position to control those actions that lead to reactions somewhere down the line, so that you can manipulate a situation in a country in Latin America, for example, by simply causing or manipulating negotiations in the Middle East, for example, because what happens there will have repercussions with their sponsors, which will have repercussions with their sponsors and their sponsors and their sponsors. And that's how the butterfly effect works internationally. Domestically, it seems to be a lot simpler. It seems to be that when you have one corporate entity that controls the uniparty, and in the United States, it's a lot easier to maintain a uniparty with two parties that just represents different sides of the corporate structure. In Canada, the people had hoped that the corporate control of the uniparty would be a little bit harder with a People's Party, the New Democratic Party, thrown into the mix. But the butterfly effect is still there. It's still very clear, and it's very, very lingering, which means that...
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, which means that over the last 10 years, what we've seen is a total effort by the corporate establishment to take control of that New Democratic Party and take control of that People's Party.
Sure. We should expect that, because
exactly
worked for them before. So, you know, I hope that the working people will stand up and fight back here. Tariq, thank you so much for coming in. And
no problem.
You can read more of his views, which are really on the money, at www.jeerobukhan.wordpress.com. So just come back sometime, okay?
Thank you so much for having me on, Ruth. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to talk politics. Just before I go, I just want to mention really, really quickly that a lot of my writing and a lot of my radio appearances in Canada, they are not the most they're not the most favorite things for the censors and thought police of the corporate establishment, I can tell you what. So
I really
appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon or this evening. Yes,
evening,
exactly.
Yeah, also, you can find Tariq on Facebook.
Absolutely. Tariq Shiro-Burkhan, I'm on Facebook. Thank you so much for your time, Ruth, and I really look forward to talking with you again soon.
Okay, yes, we'll do it. Bye-bye. And now to Raymond Blaine on Palestine.
Hello, everybody. How are you doing, Ruth? Haven't talked to you in a couple of weeks. Lots of things are happening.
That's right.
Interesting stuff. So along with Syria and everything that's going on there, they're talking about disarming Syria with their chemical weapons. And from what I've seen in the past, it's I don't know if that's such a great idea for Assad, even though it does look like it's going to stop the West from being able to just willy-nilly and throw missiles at him.
Oh, but it's a temporary stoppage. No, it won't, because the West wants to get through Syria to get Iran. So, no, it's just a stopgap.
Yeah. Well, I kind of agree with you there. And everybody that's ever done this, Saddam, he's gone. Muammar Gaddafi, he's gone. Anytime they start giving up their chemical weapons, then they don't have the deterrence that they had, and then it's just... they get after them pretty quickly. Where Syria is much different, though, than a lot of those places, is they're so well-backed by Russia, and the Soviet Union has a lot to lose if Assad were to collapse and his government were to collapse, as well as basically everybody in the world. They definitely would be hard-pressed to control the aftermath of what might happen and who might be leading these people and such. So, anyway, so that's where it's at. But as we know, Israel is one of the largest suppliers of chemical weapons. They're not suppliers, but they have one of the largest chemical weapons stockpiles in the Middle East.
Right.
And so it's making them a little bit uncomfortable that they have that now everybody kind of looking at them saying, well, what about you? And that's starting to happen, so that's a good sign.
Yeah.
If something would come of it, it'd be a better sign.
Well, that's the other thing, because they seem to be so above the law, and it seems like, I don't know why they're above the law, but they are above the law. But anyway, I read a large story, and it's about the use of chemical and biological weapons by the Israelis early on in the Palestinian conflict. During 46 and 47, they surrounded villages and would not be able to overtake them because there'd be too many people and there would be putting up too much of a resistance. So what they did to even the score was they put typhoid in the water system and then ran into the town, and it caused a big epidemic of typhoid, at which time then they were able to overrun the village because everybody was sick. And take over the village, and that's one of the ways that they ethnically cleansed areas of the country, is that they would scare off some of them, they would kill some of them, and then they would destroy the water infrastructure with chemical, biological agents, and then send that into their water system, so you couldn't come back to the area either. Dysentery was a big one that they liked to use. They had dysentery bacteria and typhoid bacteria in canteens, and half the canteen would be filled with a contaminated substance and the other half would be filled with water. And that way they could infiltrate the areas without really being noticed. Hello? Hello? Are you there?
Sorry for that. Go ahead, Blaine.
Okay, I thought I got dropped. Anyway, what they did is they would poison the water system and make the people sick, and that would help run them off. They would be able to take them over easily because they were ill. But it also contaminated the area where they couldn't come back for a large amount of time because it would make people sick. So Israel has a long history of biological and stuff. And then America has their hand in it. In the 70s, I believe it was the 70s, there was a jet that was flying from Pennsylvania to Israel, and it crashed over Holland. And it had a lot of chemicals in it that is used to make sarin gas. And I guess it made a lot of people sick, but because Germany and the Netherlands were in on it, very little was reported on it, even though it made a whole village of people sick from the crash. So we have our hands in giving them materials to make these gases and such. And they're also looking at the CIA and the different people had reported on it in the 80s as well, that they suspected that Dimona had a chemical weapons program going on there. And it's pretty well known that, you know, Israel is definitely a paranoid state that looks to do nothing but, you know, add to their arsenal to deter every and anybody that might come their way.
Well, and some of the simple things, like the gas canisters that they fire at Palestinians, they say made in U.S. on them.
Yeah, all under international law, tear gas is considered a chemical weapon. But so is white phosphorus, and in Israel and the United States didn't have any problem using that over populated areas. And that's a war crime. And I don't know why the world isn't waking up to this and saying, you know, this can't continue. But Mossad, they've been killing people with chemicals. They killed that bomb maker from Hamas. They killed Arafat with possible radioactive agent, a very, very, very rare agent. It takes less than a pin, to end of a pin to kill you, and it's very slow and it's hard to detect. And so they're constantly making evil weapons to destroy humanity. And why do we continue to let Netanyahu smile with his evil grin and his cronies continue to steal land, poison water wells, which they do to this day? This is not something that just happened during the Nakba. This is happening today. They take these wells, they pour lime in them, they pour foul substances, they pollute their farmland with sewage. That, to me, is biological warfare, which I consider to be chemical weapon warfare. So, everybody, while you're looking at Syria, I mean, it's horrible what's going on there. I still have a hard time believing that Assad had anything to do with those weapons that were put a shot at over civilian areas. I don't see him doing that. He's winning. He has the support of a large superpower and China. He has no reason to use those type of weapons to draw international criticism or international support to bomb him. So the only people that have any reason to do that would be people that are desperate, that are trying to draw Western intervention to try to help even the score or make the sides a little more even. You know, so if we're not going to do it to Israel for what they're doing to the Palestinians, I don't see how you can go and point the finger at Assad and say he's doing so many bad things. Because most of those people are coming from Turkey, they're coming from Chechnya, they're coming from all over the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Libya. They're jihadists from all over the world. And the bad thing about it for the Syrian people is that the jihadists actually are not getting along. And so there's been reports of wars and battling and fighting between the armed rebel factions. So you have the ISIS, who are an al-Qaeda affiliate. And then you have al-Nusra, who's also in the Cairo field, but they don't like each other. They're after the same pieces of land. And again, it's a lot to do with resources and such, as what's going on with Gaza as well. Now everybody is paying attention to Syria. Nobody's paying attention to Gaza. So Gaza, they've closed over 700 tunnels in the last 3 months. They're not receiving fuel through the tunnels anymore, so their fuel is not coming in. The electric company and the power station is probably going to be shut down for good. It's not going to be reopened. It's going to shut down. The construction supplies have all stopped coming in, so it's caused another shortage in work, and also their rebuilding has all been stopped. And a lot of that is schools and infrastructure and roads and things of that nature that have been paid for by the European Union, by Qatar, by all these different donor countries that come in like they're going to save the world, and then, you know, say we're going to give all this money, and then the money never shows up, or it shows up in the hands of some of the corrupt politicians that are involved with the everyday dealings with these different countries. But my friends in Gaza tell me that things are getting much, much worse. I'm hearing from people much, much less because of the power problems.
Right.
They're doing what they can, but everybody needs to double their efforts. We need to keep getting the word out that these people need our help. I had planned on trying to go on a trip there, but at this time it is too dangerous. The Sinai Peninsula is absolutely on fire, and they're not. It's not. Nobody's playing around over there. Egyptian soldiers are being killed. Regular people in Rafah are being killed because they're bulldozing their homes to make way for a huge buffer zone, and they're cranking down on Hamas. They're really, really cranking down on the Strip. So the siege has gotten much, much, much worse. And so everybody needs to, you know, if you've got friends over there, you need to figure out a way to get Rafah opened up. Everybody needs to write letters and call upon our, you know, people that are Zionist brainwashed and try to get them to pull some strings to try to get these open. Now, on the other hand, Hamas hasn't made it any easier because there's this big game they play where people get permission from the Palestinian Authority to travel through the Rafah crossing through Cairo with Egypt and the PA's blessing, and then Hamas does not recognize that. So that's another real big problem with what's going on at the border. Less than 300 people are being allowed to cross each day, and I don't believe that even that many are getting through to Cairo, and then a lot of people are stranded in Egypt. Another problem is, too, is that when you're stranded in Egypt, the Egyptian authorities are horrible to these people. They are beating them. They are running them off. They are, you know, you can't stand here, you can't stay there, there's nowhere to go, you can't. So they're treating them worse than farm animals at the border, is what I'm being told. So, you know, when they say they're opening the border, that's really a lie. It's not happening. People on the ground are telling me different. So they wanted to open it 4 hours a day, but then it always seems like somebody gets shot or somebody gets killed, or they make an excuse not to open the border. For Egypt's side of it, the Salafi, the Takafri, all these different militant groups were traveling through the tunnels between Gaza and between Egypt and the Sinai and planning attacks in Gaza and then going across. Now, this didn't have the support of the Hamas government or anybody in Gaza, but it didn't matter because now everybody gets punished. They're just like Israel, where, you know, we punish one, we punish everybody. So they're not policing their side, unfortunately, on the Gaza side, to keep these militants at bay. But I don't know how they could if they're going to get shot at and things are going to happen from the Egyptian side. It's pretty dangerous to be a Palestinian border guard or policeman.
Yeah, my goodness.
I can't imagine how scary that must be. Because, I mean, you don't know what the heck's going to happen or who might do whatever. You could be sitting there and everything could be peaceful, and out of nowhere comes an F-16 and bombs your post for no real reason. What else has happened since I had talked to you last? The 9/11 has passed, and with fanfare and a lot of racist comments, I believe. My take on 9/11 is it was the World Trade Center. It wasn't the United States of America Trade Center.
Right.
Everybody in the world was touched by this tragedy. This is not something that was cool for anybody. I mean, killed Muslims, killed Jews, killed Christians.
People from 80 to 100 countries were killed in
wasn't one country in this planet that wasn't touched in one way or another by the events of 9/11. But with all the things that have come out since that time, and how we know that Prince Bandahar had so much to do with it, with Saudi Arabia and possibly Israel and the Mossad and all these different things that have come out, how can we possibly sit here and watch Saudi Arabia ruin our country by holding us hostage to the oil dollar, and then also not retaliating for these things. I'm very upset that, you know, we're after all these countries that have never done anything to us, and then the countries that have been just completely heinous, and on top of that, their human rights record is horrendous. And we support these people. I'm losing hope in people if they can't see, you know, that if we're going to use our military to freaking take over places that are dictatorial like Saudi Arabia. You know, these prince and emirs, they're so rich, and they're on our backs. You know, every time you fill up that SUV, you put another Arab freaking Saudi prince's kid through college here in the United States. So, I don't know. I mean, we need to do some soul searching, people, and we need to look for the evil and get rid of it and quit picking on the freaking innocent. The innocent doesn't have a voice, it seems. And that's why we're here. I'm trying to.
That's why you're talking now. That's why. Yes.
Give somebody some voices. Give them a voice. Let them know, you know, that we care and that, you know, we are trying to make a difference in this world and make things happen to help all of humanity, not just people that are in dire need. I mean, I guess that's where we got to start. The Syrian refugees thing, I think there's 3 million refugees now. That's all, there were 17 million people that live in that country, so there's still a whole lot of people there. I mean, if only 3 million were, the 3 million were the rich ones, the ones that could afford to leave.
Yeah.
The other ones are can't afford to leave. And so what do? And then these people come into, these people from other countries that the United States is arming and feeding and housing and training and sending them over to these poor villages where these people have been just terrified for months and months, and now they're in a weakened state, and these militias easily run them over. They're better equipped. They're well fed. And Turkey sits there and just says, we got to get him.
Yeah.
You know, when is the retaliation going to happen? When is Syria going to get mad enough to say, Turkey, I've had enough of you? I mean,
yeah,
I don't think that that'll happen, but because they're so strong with NATO allies, America backing them up, and Israel for that matter. But when's enough enough? And somebody just says, you know what, I'm tired of this. You know, you guys. So everybody, when you see the retaliation, don't be pointing the finger back at Syria saying, well, see, I told you. He's been trying to protect the Palestinians to some extent. He's treated Palestinians well in their country, not great, because no country really has. But every country's wanted them to go home. And I think everybody in Palestine wants to go home. So that's kind of a, you know, non-starter. When people say, oh, well, we'd have peace if the Arab countries would just absorb their Palestinian guests. I said, well, that'd be great, but who's going to pay for that? And why can't they go back to their homes? Because of racist policies of a government? That it doesn't even have a country? Doesn't have defined borders? As one of the largest militaries in the world. Yeah. And also with all the Syria stuff too, no talk of peace plan or negotiations that they speak of. Freaking Kerry's bouncing around talking about Syria. How could he possibly be serious about making peace being the Palestinians in Israel if he's continually just bouncing between the two places? And then going to talk to Netanyahu about Iran and Syria, not about Palestine. So, just doesn't look good. It doesn't look good. Everything, you know, everything looks pretty horrible in Gaza and the West Bank. They're murdering people every day. They pulled a guy off his roof last week. He identified himself. He was shot in cold blood in his front door and drug off. Front of his family, never to be seen again. You know, his brother's in prison for being
19-year-old. They raided the village, and they went in. And he was trying to escape because once he figured out what was happening, but they shot him and he died.
He was asleep.
Yeah,
he was asleep. He shot his brother, and then drug made him go upstairs and identify his other brother. And as soon as he identified him, drug him down the stairs and executed him. And then anywhere else in the world, there'd be a huge uproar. People just sit there and just watch. You know, they act like it's a reality TV show or something.
You know, people in this country don't know what's happening. They don't know what's happening because they are watching some stupid so-called reality show on TV. People in this country don't know what's going on.
Right.
Because they're watching mainstream media.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's unfortunate that people are so, I don't know, I almost call it selfish. They just, not in my backyard, not going to worry about it. And so, until it hits their backyard, and then they all cry and complain, and why me, and blah, blah, blah. When,
why
if we were watching
help?
Outside, over the fence, you know, that reminds me of a little girl I read a story about that's 12. She hasn't seen her dad in 8 years. She's, last time she was able to see him, she was like 5 or 6 or something like that, and now she's 12, and you ask her, you know, one of the psychologists asked her to write a picture, draw a picture, and she did, of this giraffe looking over this wall, and she said, well, what's that? And she said, well, the giraffe has a long neck, and he can see over the wall into the prison, and then he looks over my dad and then tells me that my dad's okay. And,
oh, my God.
It's amazing. But, you know, these kids are growing up without parents. The only reason he was arrested is because he freaking, you know, he was against the wall and he had protested a settlement that was built on their land in the village. And, you know, he was just doing what the men were doing. They were trying to protect their properties, which that's not allowed. And then the Bedouin problem in the Negev is getting worse and worse and worse. The UN and Red Cross, they came and they demolished the whole village. It left like 150 people out in the elements. And so the Red Cross came with new tents and stuff to set them back up again. And the military came and beat the Red Cross workers and the aid workers and the villagers and stole all the tents and left. So they weren't able to set up their village again. So they're not looking to make buffer zones there. They're looking to build settlements there. And so they talk about, oh, we need this for security. That's not the truth. And so they continue to lie and lie and lie and get away with it because our government is completely complacent and doesn't really care.
And paid up.
Or does care, but doesn't fit their role.
Yep.
Yeah, that's very true. And they pay both sides. And so we need a third party, really. We need someone that can stand up to that. But at the same time, anybody that stands up to it, they're assassinated. I mean, Yitzhak Rabin, John F. Kennedy. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
We need to take down the system. It's not working.
Yeah.
The university does not work. Capitalism does not work.
Well, the 1% has the 99% divided and all screwed up. And that's right where they want us.
That's right where they
want
us.
So when I see, you know, million bikers march for 9/11 against the 25 million Muslim march, they should be marching together, not against each other.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, this country was built on a melting pot. This country is, well, built on stolen land. You know, I mean, but we were from everywhere in the world. I mean, Miss America is from, you know, of Indian descent. Wonderful. But then the half America saying, what are we doing? All about now? Obama's happy we got a Muslim Miss America. Wow, what? I mean, so the ignorance is still just
ignorance is thriving, Glenn, thriving.
There is no shortage of it. No shortage of it. It's like, come on. You know? Well, that's what we are. We are a country of a lot of religions and cultures and ideas. And we're not free, but we're, you know, I mean, I'm not worried about the police coming and raiding my apartment and shooting me in the head, execution style, because I guess they're judge, jury, and executioner. I don't know what he did or who he talked to or why they were mad at him, but something was up. He must have pissed somebody off. or maybe not. Maybe he just was the next target on the list.
Yeah.
You know, who knows what's going through the Zionist minds? You know, a lot of it, a lot of people are saying, and I kind of believe this too, is there's a lot of Zionist settler fanatics in the military and police force. So you get 3-4 of them in a group. They
yeah.
don't want the peace stuff to go through. So mm-hmm. they're trying to get the Palestinians to walk away and say, man, you guys keep screwing this up. We're done. We're not negotiating with terrorists. And that's what they want, because then if we don't,
yeah.
there's no negotiations. They just build and build and build and build. And nothing happens except Palestinians lose more land, Jews retain more property, and everything stays the same. Well, no, nothing stays the same. Actually, things get much, much worse
yeah.
for the Palestinians, and much, much better, depending on how you look at it, for the Jews and the European Jews from all over Europe and New York and some of the most fanatic settlers in the world. So we just can't have this continue to go on. This needs to change. So if anybody's got any great ideas, I'm all ears.
Yeah.
To go there is almost impossible now with the closures. And because of those closures, Israel is clamped down even more because they can. And nobody's doing anything about that. I'll tell you a little funny story. I have a friend named, I want to mention her name, actually. She goes to Israel in Haifa to see family. She's an Arab Israeli that lives in New York. And she gets harassed at the airport when she leaves, every time she leaves. But she's pretty used to it. So she, plays around with these people. So this was no different than before.
Or when she leaves there?
When she leaves there, trying to come back home. So for the little backstory, they will not leave an Arab in an Israeli airport. So any of you Arabs that fly to Israel, if you go 4 hours early, it'll take 4 hours for you to get to your plane. If you go 2 hours early, it'll take 2 hours. If you go 1 hour, it'll take 1 hour. All they want is you to be hung up until time for you to get your flight. Do not run to your flight. Take your time. They will not leave an Arab in their airport. They will wait 30, 40, 50 minutes for you to show up. If you smoke a cigarette,
really?
If you smoke cigarettes, go to the smoking room after they release you and let them call your name over the loudspeaker. They will not leave you in the airport. I'm telling you, they will not leave you in the airport.
Wow.
The reason I know this is because she was harassed at the airport and used to run to the airport. So then when she got through the airport, she'd be sweating and dying and all this. Well, she got mad one time because they made her go through all this stuff, and she decided she wanted a cigarette. Well, they called her name over the loudspeaker 3 or 4 times. And when she finally got to the gate, they said to her, "What was the delay?" And she said, "Oh, no, I was here 4 hours early. You're the delay," and got on the airplane.
Wow.
So this time, not much different. She's a freaking pistol. She's so funny. She goes to the airport. They call her by her Arabic name. She never gets called by her Arabic name. She said by a blonde girl that was sent from New York to steal a Palestinian's home. And then the girl said, I know Arabs do the right security. So she goes with them, and they made her unpack and pack her suitcase 7 times. Seven times. Then she gets to the security desk, and they tell her ask her how long she'd been in Israel, and she said 3 months. And she asked her 4 times, and on the 4th time she said, "Do you want me to text that to you?" So the lady wasn't very happy. Then she sees her Palestinian flag tattoo on her neck and says, "You have tattoos." And she says, "Yes." She, as she's counting them, one, two, and she says, "Where is the third one?" She says, "On my ass. You want to see it?" She says, "This is only for your protection and your security for your flight."
Right. Honestly. No, unpacking and packing your luggage 7 times.
So anyway, it was...
Right.
She makes a joke out of it.
Yeah.
Right. She makes a joke out of it, but it's not funny.
Right.
Unpack and pack your suitcase 7 times. Are you kidding me? For what? For her security.
Yeah, see that? That's
for the security of the other passengers.
Right. Yeah. That's
very
right.
Funny stuff. So anyway, she makes light of it. Unfortunately, a lot of younger people, teenagers, kids, they all get harassed the same way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's terrible. I mean, this is in an international airport of a supposed democratic.
Oh, well, democratic. We know what a racist country it is. So
the only democracy in the Middle East.
Isn't that funny?
State of
that's
America.
They built themselves? That's amazing.
Yeah, they really like to say that. They really love to say the only democracy in the Middle East. Which I find interesting because I don't see anything democratic about all Jewish.
No.
I don't get that at all.
And you know, you didn't even touch on the today about the, as far as being racist, you know, the Jews and Arabs aren't supposed to marry, and I mean they're very down on that. And
Well, like, you know, Sarit talks about, you know, there's a lot going on. I mean, with the Jews in Israel that are against all this apartheid.
Yeah.
I mean, they are treated just as bad as the Palestinians, just as bad as anybody else, the African migrants, immigrants, and all
they're
that.
They're beat up on. She was supposed to come on tonight, but she hasn't made it. I think she was up a long time, like till middle of the morning, making jewelry. So she was sleeping on and off today, so I bet she's asleep. But, no, she has a lot of friends in Israel. And, I mean, she knows because she fights with a lot of people online who are major Zionists. But she does have a lot of friends who actually are very pro-Palestinian. And they take lives in their hands. Speaking
they
out,
they really do.
They do speak out.
But you know,
out.
they did do something that I thought was incredibly cool, and I hope they do it some more. And they started picketing and started to go after the U.S. embassy in Israel, and saying, "You guys are financing this. You guys are the reason for this."
Well,
and so they're
right.
Starting to picket and starting to go after the American embassy and the European embassies. I'm like, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Go after the people that are paying for it. Because Israel couldn't do this stuff if somebody wasn't paying them to do it. But chemical weapons, the Jews, Israel has been practicing and using them on the Palestinians for years.
Sure. Yeah.
You know,
well,
and nobody
like
talks
our
about
government,
it.
You know, our government's been using it on us, too. Like, look at chemtrails. Look at a lot of other things that they do that they don't tell people about. Like when they did St. Louis years ago. You know, our government does that stuff too. But of course, our government and Israel are so entwined. Of course, they would.
And that's the scary part. I mean, and I even read some other stuff. I don't know how true it is, but how the Shin Bet and all them have Netanyahu just hamstrung too, and that you know, if like any leader of that country, if they go and make, land deals or trying any type of peace deal or anything, they're assassinated. And Shin Bet just lets it happen and they set it up. And so,
You
know, I mean, look at Rabin. I mean, you can't get much better than that. I mean, he was, come on, they walked right up to him point blank range and shot him dead. And in the most secure country in the world,
There you go.
Wow, really? How does that happen? And then somebody even filmed it? Come on. That to me, that's just too much. You know?
Yeah, I know.
But that's a scary thought. You know, I mean, they just squash you. They don't play. I will give them that. They're really good at what they do.
Yeah, you know? They are. They are trained well, very well.
They are very
brain.
They are assassins.
Whatever you want to call it, but yeah, a great job has been done on them. But well, Blaine, I hope that the power plant thing isn't going to affect your corresponding and talking with those youngsters. That's just, it's really bad because most people I talk to go to coffee houses and get online. And yeah, the hours, they're really cutting. So I hope that. So we have, okay, Blaine dropped and you're back. Strange, huh?
Hello, I'm here.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so anyway, I was just going to sign off. This is Raymond Blaine on Palestine, and you all have a great evening.
And we'll see you next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday. Great.
After
equinox.
Yes, okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. You're welcome. Have a nice night.
You too.
Using ancient techniques taught by our ancestors, we express the spirit of tradition from cultures all across the planet. We blend by hand and we create with light and intention for use, using fragrance and subtle essences to awaken your sensuality, both physical and subtle, all for the mystical exploration of you. DaughtersofIsis.com. Come find us.
We are an associate of the Commons Project Network. You can find us at www.thecommonsprojectnetwork.com. And so we will say goodnight to everybody.